Blog Talk Radio.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Buzz People. Thank you. Thank you. Oh. They went back to drinking awful fast. Uh-oh. Am I there?
Oh, I'm not there. Okay. I had my,
oh, okay. I started panicking.
I was talking. Yeah,
the bus people got quiet real fast. They went back to drinking, and then you didn't say anything, and I thought, oh, no, I'm lost again. Here we go. But,
I was talking, but I forgot to hit the little button for my microphone. So.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I really started to panic a bit there. I really did. All right. Welcome to All About Wine, our September 21st, 2023 edition. I don't know. Yeah, I guess we can say this is episode number whatever, but I have absolutely no idea how many episodes we've actually done, so I can't do that. Yeah. But
there was a I found somewhere. I thought it was like 600. I think Blog Talk Radio has 740. Oh, no, that's hours. It's in here.
Is it?
Yeah.
650 episodes. Boy, we've been doing this since 2009, and we still got nowhere near 1,000. It's going to be forever.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I guess 52 weeks a year or so. That's and we don't do it every week because we have had our issues. So.
Yeah.
So 650 is pretty good number.
Mm-hmm.
I asked you before our little girl jumped in and started the show on is I understand you're doing a first and 15th on Flightline Radio.
Still working on it and
are you?
I was going back and forth with Phil and Cap and doing a test. Did a test on Sunday. And the stream is playing, but the titles were not coming through. So it looked if I let it play, it looked like I had the song that was playing before that is over an hour long. So I have to fix it. have to get the titles out there. And but it was automated, and that was good. Just working on a way to do it with the titles and everything. And then I did a test with All About Wine, and the show played from Blog Talk Radio. But again, the titles were messed up. So I've been going back and forth with support. Yeah, I've been contacting support and trying to find. I've got two softwares running right now that are going to run all the time and download the latest episodes. And then I have another software that's going to upload the episodes. And I'm just that's what I'm working out now. So can it stop? But
yeah.
Well, I'm trying to find a automated way so it'll. Get in there somehow.
Flightline Radio, everyone. Be sure to tune in. Flightlineradio.com. It's Mike's streaming station on all the music you've heard before and have never heard before. And he is also live on Saturday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And I have to say that because Flightline Radio and All About Wine are listened to around the world, so... We need to be sure that they get the proper times on those. So, good time. Mike does a good job on it. He used to do Friday nights, and I was listening to a lot more than the Saturday mornings.
It is early.
Yeah. 7:79. I sometimes catch the last half hour or so, but you know, not 7 o'clock. Yeah, that's. I'll leave that for you, okay. Young guys. Yeah. So.
I try to get up.
Yeah. Get up and get it done. I can just see you getting up, stumbling into the. Mix board, just hit play and then stumble around for a little bit, go get your coffee and come back in and sit down. And
yeah. Yep. It takes a while.
Yeah. So, but Flight Line Radio, check it out. They have, like I say, 24/7 streaming. You can always put on your computer in the background and listen to it. And not a whole lot of advertisements either. You can tune it in, and in the background, you don't have to worry about, you know, you got
other
more.
Than, other than the, you know, the little IDs, and then I do one for All About Wine on Thursdays, and then one for meeting DJs, or DJs can apply. We went ad-free the weekend also, so I don't have to.
Oh, really?
Not saying that we won't have any if it comes up to that. I'd be more than happy.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, that's right.
On weekends, really? I hardly ever listen to it on weekends. I'm usually playing golf. Yeah,
it's a commercial free 24/7 now. But I started it last weekend.
Okay.
So,
all right, very good. Well, there you go. You don't have to, you know. Tune into it and play it in the background. That's really a good way to do it. Just, you know, tune the thing in and play it in the background, and while you're browsing your computer or reading emails or laughing at different memes or whatever you're doing, it's a good way to keep yourself entertained. So good, no advertisements. That's a cool thing. Almost like serious radio. There, you just no advertisements. So, all right, very good. We're supposed to have a guest coming on pretty soon here. Jim Butler from Butler Winery is located in Bloomington, Indiana. And so he's supposed to be contacting us. It's already, what, 7 after? Ooh. I wonder where he is. And I was going to say we'd call him, but the problem with calling him is it would interfere with our Facebook connection. Calling him, they gave us his phone number and said this is his number, and I confirmed this afternoon that he needs to call in to us a few minutes after 7 at our guest call-in line. And he hasn't yet, so... Well, while we are waiting, geez, I always hate this when we get confusion like this because I usually don't prepare for anything. And now, all right, this is something that I'll go through with you while we're waiting for Jim to join us. This is out of Chain Drug Review. It's a magazine I get. I still get it when I was working at the winery, and I still have it coming in. It's from September the 4th, so last week. Excuse me, actually, more like 2 weeks ago, isn't it? September 4th. But it says, private label wines and spirits are the toast of the town. Let's raise a glass to private label wine. Okay, now private label wine is when you have a company like, I don't know, any of them, name a wine company, and a business or a store or something gets a hold of them and says, we want you to make wine for us, but we want to put our label on it so that we can sell it. That's actually what Aldi's does. If you've ever bought wine at Aldi's, they have their line of wines, and that's made by they don't have a winery or tanks or vineyards or anything. They buy the wine and have the labels put on it. There's, I want to say, 6 or 7 big places in California that do that, that make private label wines for pretty much anybody or everybody. And they're not bad. I mean, okay, let's, I'm not criticizing it. The private label wines are decent. But most of the time, the places that do private label wines, or that want private label wine stores, like to keep the price within their price category for their store. And so because of that, it makes a difference in quality of grapes and things. You know, that all comes into play. But it says that the dollar sales in all U.S. outlets jumped 9.1% for the 52 weeks ended June 18th versus the same period last year. It jumped 9.1% to $52.2 million. Private label. What's more, unit sales grew 8% for the same period. So it's private labels are jumping up. But a lot of time, private labels is a little bit less expensive than others, and people will find one that they like and continue to buy it. Store brand spirits also have jumped up by 3.2% to $5.2 million. So the private label is really a pretty big pretty big market out there. So I'll cover some more of that at another time. But we do have our guest sitting in the background, sitting in the green room, and we'll bring him on. Hello, Jim. Welcome to All About Wine.
Hello. Hello, Ron. I seem to have been given the wrong phone number, but I found you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I guess we know who to blame for that, don't we?
I don't know. Lost in translation.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad you tracked us down. I was sitting there going, wait a minute, Jim should be here. And you know, maybe Angela transposed it or something? I don't know.
We'll figure that out later.
Yeah, well, you're here. That's what counts.
Yep.
So, Butler Winery, that is located in, of all places, Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana.
It is, yes.
Yeah, one does not immediately think of Bloomington, Indiana when one thinks of wine. I'm going to ask you to start out here telling us the story. You know,
how far back do you want me to go?
Well, you can jump past your growing up and your formative years, but you know, let's.
Well, I was going to go back to 1802.
1802? Okay, I understand the reasoning for that now. So do that. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, but Indiana's been a wine-producing state for a couple of hundred years.
Hmm.
In fact, the first successful commercial wine production in the country is said to be in Vivi, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
So, but our story starts, we opened up in 1983. I'd been the winemaker at Oliver Winery for 6 years before that and decided to leave, you know, how restaurants and chefs travel around and such. So we opened up in 83, and so we've got 40 years in now.
Wow. That's quite some time. At the same location?
Yes. Yeah, actually we have two locations here in Bloomington. We have a downtown location, which is at this point just a tasting room, but that's actually where we started the winery. Then we bought the property for the vineyard in 1991, moved all the production out here, and so this is our main focus, but we still have a downtown tasting room.
Uh-huh. How many acres do you have now?
We're growing between 5 and 6 acres right now.
Okay, and that's right next to the winery then?
Yeah, it kind of surrounds the winery, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, I was looking at the story of the winery and all that, and I noticed you attended University of Minnesota. Is that where you got your background for wine?
I got a master's there in aquatic ecology.
Aquatic
so basically, it's like yes, it's like oceanography, except it's fresh water instead of salt water. So I just tell people we're just turning water into wine now.
Yeah. Well, the reason I laughed is, you know, I mean, the difference between what you got a master's in and what you're doing is not really related.
Yeah. Well, it's all chemistry. Water chemistry. So I had undergraduate at Indiana University here in Bloomington in biology and chemistry, and then went up there for 3 years and worked on the lakes up there, and then we called it three winters, and then we moved back to a more southern climb here in Indiana.
Yeah. That's funny. We're in Florida. That's funny you say southern climb in Indiana.
It's all relative.
It is. It is at that, yeah. You opened up the winery in,
73? 83, yeah. Yeah, okay. I worked at Oliver Winery here in Bloomington from 76 to 82, and then we opened up in 83.
Okay. And when you first opened, did you have an idea of what grapes you were going to be using, or has it just been, you know, the roll of the dice and what's working?
We're pretty much focused in this area on a lot of the French hybrid grapes that were developed in the late 1800s, mid-1800s. When phylloxera got to Europe, the French did two things. They crossbred North American parentage into vinifera, and then they decided they could graft onto rootstock. So most of what is here is, you know, it's on its own roots. It's those older French hybrid varieties. There's some Minnesota varieties here now. People are growing as well. And we planted vinifera twice. The polar vortex took out our Cab Franc. We tried some Tanat and a similar thing. But we can get winters of 10 to 15 below zero on occasion, which, as you know, takes 4 years to get a commercial crop.
Yeah.
If that happens every 5 to 10 years, it puts a lot of pressure on the vineyard that way.
Oh, yeah.
So these varieties with that little bit of North American parentage are more winter hardy. But the really nice thing is you can lose a vine down to the ground. You've still got the root system. It's not grafted. You grew up a new vine the next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
well, that's
true. You don't lose 4 years. You lose maybe one.
Does the ground get cold enough there to freeze the roots at any time?
Not really, no.
Not really, okay.
I mean, yeah, I mean, freeze depth here is, you know, it's 2 feet, but the roots, there's no problem there.
Yeah, they're down quite a ways. That's one of the problems when you get further north, that roots get frozen and that kills it all there. Are you not using any of the University of Minnesota winter hardy grapes then?
We have a neighbor down the road a couple miles who's growing Marquette for us.
Oh.
And it's those grapes are developed for a short season. So here it's ripening in mid-August.
Oh, wow.
It's still 90 degrees out. And so the ripening goes relatively quickly. It's a short window. Sugars can go way up. And then you're also picking when it's hot. But and the birds love it. The birds love the early, small red berries. Absolutely.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, I bet they do. And it's too much of a hassle to net. So just, you know, don't grow it.
Yeah, we started netting not everything yet, but certain varieties 2 or 3 years ago because the birds have just been an increasing problem, and I see this in a lot of places. I think it's learned behavior. So the netting, you know, you can do the scare eyes, you can do the distress calls, but the netting is really what, you know, keeps them out 95%.
Wow.
So it's a tedious task.
Yeah. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that you're netting there. I didn't realize that the birds were getting that bad. I mean, I suppose Indiana is right in a fly path, so.
Yeah. And we're seeing birds here that we've never really seen before in the vineyard. The orchard orioles They're just little vandals. They'll come and sit on a cluster, and they'll peck every berry like you're sitting there popping bubble wrap. a robin will take a berry and fly off with it and eat it and come back for another one, but these guys are vandals.
Oh, geez.
They're just taking a little sip out of each berry.
And just destroy it. Yeah.
Yep.
Is the netting tight enough to keep them out?
It is, and then they get caught in it when they try to fly out.
Oh.
So it's kind of, they can be self-destructive that way.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Their head's just the right size to fit and get caught in the netting.
Oh, well, that's too bad for them. Maybe maybe they will learn. You know. Pass it on. Oh, look, Jim's caught in the net. Maybe we should stay away from that. You know.
I think so, yeah.
So you, before I get and talk about your wines, you wrote a book, you and your son.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, oldest son, yeah.
Yeah. Indiana wine.
Indiana.
Is this grapes, wine, wineries? What is the book?
It's the history of wine in Indiana. I had heard about the Swiss settlers in Vivi, which is Switzerland County on the Ohio River in kind of southeast corner of Indiana. And the more I researched, the more I found, the more fascinating it became. And it was a family of French-speaking Swiss that settled in Kentucky in 1799, 1802, in that period, and planted grapes. They brought 35 varieties from Philadelphia and New York that they found and planted them there, and all of them died except for two. And land came up for sale in Indiana, they moved the whole family up there just on the river. And that's kind of the seed of commercial winemaking in the area. Predated Cincinnati, which was the wine capital of the country up until the Civil War. So 1805 or 6, first harvest, and it was probably gone by about 1830. So there's various economic factors why, but that was kind of the first commercial wine production in the country.
Wow.
So that's kind of what the book is about. And then we had a second little phase there in the 1820s, in New Harmony, the Harmonites, which was a German religious group that settled there. And they were there for about 10 years, and then they moved back to Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So people from Vivi moved to Cincinnati, and then people from Cincinnati moved up to the Great Lakes area. And then, you know, Herman, Missouri, that came on in the 1840s, 50s, and, you know, that was the biggest wine production area until California started coming on in the 1860s.
Right. Yeah. I've been to Indiana, southern Indiana, along the border, across the border, over into Kentucky and the wineries around Kentucky there and all that. And fascinating. Along the Ohio River, quite a few wineries in that area there.
Yeah.
And I had the opportunity to visit quite a few of those. The only winery I visited in Indianapolis, was it? Yes, it was. No, Cincinnati it was. There was one downtown Cincinnati that I visited. But, there's a lot of great wineries along the river there in Indiana.
There's a viticulture, the Ohio River Valley viticultural area.
Oh, it is an AVA there? Yeah.
Yeah, from the Indiana-Illinois border up through West Virginia, you know, roughly 20, 25 miles each side of the river. There's kind of an airflow pattern through there. And then where we are, Bloomington on south towards the river, is the Indiana Uplands AVA. And that's a more recent one.
Yeah. Whenever their new AVA starts coming out, I always talk about it on the show here. And I try to educate people on AVAs because most people aren't familiar with them, you know, which is sad. But
no.
Yeah.
Well, there's over 200 in the country, probably 250 now.
Yeah.
We're number 213.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're all over the place. And, you know, but most people aren't familiar with what an AVA is, which is really, really sad considering, you know, all the effort and everything that goes into it and the distinction of the soils and everything. So,
mm-hmm.
but try to keep people educated and as much as I can on this show here. So the book is available through Amazon?
The book is actually out of print, but you can get it on Amazon as a used copy.
Oh, okay. So Indiana, a history, or Indiana Wine, a history. And
correct.
Published by Indiana University Press. It's 2001.
Right.
So if anybody's interested in it, then you can, you know, Amazon, I guess, has copies available. Or what is the other book company? I can kind of think of it. I always think of Amazon. But, yeah, there you go. If anybody's interested in Indiana wine. Sounds like it's interesting. You did some good research on it and a little background of that area and everything.
It was a fun little mystery story, actually. Just we did a lot of this research really before internet and a lot of writing to libraries. We found a lot of original documents in French that we had to translate and decipher people's handwriting. So I say it was kind of a little mystery to solve. But, and since that time, I've been contacted by numerous people who are descendants of the Dufour family or, you know, found a document in the trunk of their car in Las Vegas, you know. Just all sorts of things have happened.
Oh, you need to do a follow-up, you know.
Yeah, that takes time. It's on the agenda.
Okay. not trying to push you, but it's just something you need to start putting the notes together. Yeah, that's,
exactly.
Yeah. So, you, let's see, here we go. Wine. Your wines. I want to talk about all of your wines. You have how many whites?
Well, you would ask me a question on the number of whites. We have 3 dry whites, 3 semi-sweets. We do a sweet Catawba. We do a peach. I consider that a white wine. So we do. I think we have about 23 wines on the list currently.
Wow. Yeah. So let's talk about your dry ones. Cuyahoga, that is, you get that from New York?
That we buy from New York, yes.
Okay.
And we just do a simple fermentation, you know, nothing fancy. It usually has a nice little crisp character to it, and we call it White Select. And people come in, you know, people always come in and say, what do you have that tastes like a Moscato? What do you have that's a Pinot Grigio? What do you have that's a Cabernet? You say, well, we don't grow any of those, but here's what we grow, and this is going to be similar. So, you know, White Select is kind of a dry Pinot Grigio, no oak, you know, straightforward, good, clean, fresh.
Just a little bit of acid to give it a little bite there. And it kind of got that, yeah.
Yeah, we also grow Chardonnay, and we do that kind of more of the full Chardonnay barrel ML style wine. Now, unfortunately, this spring we had a frost, and we have essentially zero Chardonnay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a small crop this year. But on before that, we right before Christmas Eve, the day before, we were 41 degrees in the afternoon, and by morning it was 10 below zero.
Oh, my gosh.
So on Chardonnay, that took out, you know, 90% of the primary buds. And then secondaries are coming out in April, and around April 24th, they got frosted. So we had a kind of a double whammy this year.
Oh,
we've been
no.
growing grapes for 30 years, and we've had 2 frosts of this magnitude, but they've both been in the last 4 years. So, you know, we're seeing that earlier bud break with a little bit earlier spring, but we're still getting those variable temperatures that can, you know, bring us a frost. And so we're kind of being set up for more frost damage than we've had in the past, I think.
Yeah.
So
part
of the answer to that is, you know, varietal selection. We're on a hilltop here. We're 300 feet above the Bean Blossom Valley.
Well,
that
offers
us
some
protection. You know, maybe on a cold winter morning, it can be 10 or 15 degree difference.
The frost, I remember Missouri had a serious problem that same year that you had that frost problem. They lost a lot of their frost.
Yeah, this frost was from Wisconsin through New York this year.
Oh.
So New York even has a smaller crop.
Wow.
We're getting these polar outbreaks. If it's midwinter, you know, they call it the cyclone bomb. We get
yes.
real big temperature drop. So it's kind of this changing climate thing we're seeing. I've been tracking
really
weather records for 30 years, and you can see it in the averages and the statistics.
And you know, it's just people talk about climate change, and they immediately think about, well, we set a new record for heat this summer, but it's also the variations and things like those frosts and hail
mm-hmm.
over in the Burgundy region of France and stuff like that. These are all
right
attributed to the climate change. It's not just a heat wave or something. You
right.
know,
so part of it's varietal selection, and we have some 3-year-old Sauvignon Blanc. And they went through the drop to 10 below and the spring frost, and we actually had to do a little cluster thinning on that this spring because the crop was too heavy on it.
Oh, really?
So, yes, some of these varieties are very hardy. Sauvignon Blanc more or less will bloom all summer long, and so you have these clusters of very different ages. So I've always heard that Sauvignon had to be cluster thinned. And now I see why. I mean, we usually do some, you know, normal cluster thinning, but this is excessive. So that might be one of the ones we'll be looking at more.
Yeah, that's, that could be a good thing. And that way, if a frost comes in, you're not destroying the whole thing. You know. That,
right. The other variety that we saw good response was Norton. We've got 4-year-old Norton, and that came through fairly well.
Norton is a unusual grape. I had I can't think of his name now, expert on Native American grapes, and he was talking about the Norton, and he said it's being grown all over the place, and it's made sweet, and it's dry, and it's withstanding winters, and it's surviving heat, and Norton has just become a phenomenal grape for everyone, it seems.
Yeah, as you say, it's an unusual grape. It has its own particular taste. But, we haven't had a lot of experience with the winemaking of it. Norton was the grape that the Germans out in Missouri and Hermann based their industry on back in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
It's named after Dr. Norton.
Yeah. And it's planted all over the Midwest. In fact, there is a winery that is, I had a winery up about 45 minutes from here, and there was one about 15, 20 minutes from where I had my winery, and he put Norton in the ground about 8 years ago, and it's growing,
mm-hmm.
and he's getting good results with it. So,
And
it's not being affected by Pierce disease.
Okay. Yeah, we find it's slow to get established. And we're on, we call these ridgetop farms here. You know, they were farmed for 150 years, and most of the good soil has been eroded away. So we're on a fairly low productive soil. So Norton can be overly vegetative, but for us it doesn't appear that it's going to be that way.
Oh, really? Oh. Are you planning on making it in a dry stall or a sweet stall?
Dry
a
style,
rosé?
Dry barrel age style.
Okay, because I've tasted Norton in every style imaginable. I mean, people have done everything with it. No,
I've had some good Norton rosé.
I've had rosés, which isn't bad, really. In fact, there's a winery, and I'm trying to think of where it is, and for the life of me, I can't right now. But there's one that's making a sparkling wine out of the Norton. And he says it's turning out really quite well. So I don't know.
Okay.
Norton is just being used and made in the gamut of possibilities. So it's interesting.
The largest planting right now I've heard is Chrysalis Vineyards in Virginia. They've like 40 acres of it or something. Mm-hmm.
They don't call it Norton there, do they? Isn't there another name?
The other name is Cynthiana. You run across that out in Arkansas and parts of Missouri.
Okay, Cynthiana.
Genetically,
that's what I was trying to
think. I think genetically they've been shown to pretty much be the same grape.
Yes.
One person told me south of the Missouri River they call it Cynthiana, north of the Missouri River they call it Norton. I'm not sure about that either.
Yeah, I'll have to check into that. I've never heard of that before. You know, Cynthiana, that's why I always forget. Norton has become the most common name for it now.
Yeah, that's the name we use, yeah.
Yeah, that's the name most everyone uses. I'm going down through your list here. Your next dry wine, a red select. Now, this one, it seems to be quite a blend here. Chamberson
is the main red grape we grow. Our neighbor grows Marquette. Once in a while, we'll buy some Foch or Baca Noir out of New York if we need to kind of fill in. But, again, this kind of goes along with the white select. It's a non-oaked, straightforward dry red. You know, it's a little on the lighter side. It's a good summer dry red, or what we say is sort of an introductory dry red.
No, there
you go. Just dries lighter, fruit-forward style.
Not a lot of tannins, just...
Correct, yeah.
One that goes well with lighter foods and stuff. Yeah, that sounds good. And then the variant, that is...
The variant is a variation on the Chamberson. So we blend Chamberson with Marquette. Marquette is grown down the road, and... We put it in oak for 6-7 months. It gets a pretty good balance. You know, none of the grapes that we're growing here are highly tannic. Partly it's the climate, partly it's the grape varieties. So I usually tell people we're going to be more like a Pinot Noir than a Cabernet. We're not making big Cabernet-style wines here in the Midwest. Say we're a little on the softer side.
And
very food-friendly.
And that's just what's good to have with food, because you don't have that tannins that are going to be overpowering any other thing you put in your mouth. You know that,
right?
The Chambord.
And then our alcohols run around 12% on the upper side.
Well.
Once in a while, we'll get a Chardonnay at 13, but generally 11 to 12% is where we come out. So again, they're not the high alcohol styles.
Which, if someone's looking for something that's a little bit lighter and fruitier, then these wines are perfect for that, because you're keeping those alcohol levels down. And it's not going to be this burny alcohol sting that you find in a lot of California wines that make these wines at, you know, 16.5-17% alcohol.
Right. So, yeah, we are 180 degrees from what California does.
Oh, yeah.
Our youngest son and his wife just moved here about a month ago, and they've both been working in Napa Valley for, I don't know, 12 or 15 years.
Oh, wow.
So they're bringing a huge amount of experience here. So it's kind of fun. He grew up in the winery here, so. And she's from Chile, so she's worked in Chile and New Zealand and South Africa and Germany and Switzerland and California.
Wow.
You know, young people, you can get two harvests in, you know, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
So that's why these young people get a lot of experience traveling back and forth and doing a lot of different things in different places.
Yeah. And when you're young, you can do that stuff. And
that's right.
As you get older, it's just like, oh, I'm so tired. I don't think I want to fly down there this year.
It didn't work 20 hours a day.
That's right. Your rosé, your Chamberson rosé, is that real dry rosé?
It's about a 0.5% residual sugar usually. And Chamberson just makes a fantastic rosé. It's got this real nice aroma, strawberry, kiwi, sometimes a little bit of grapefruit. I usually don't put grapefruit on the tasting list because people see grapefruit and it's like, ooh. But it's a little bit of the aroma. But it's one of, for the people who are real, I'll use the word, vinifera snobs, Mm-hmm. This is one that they kind of raises their eyebrows and they go, oh, I like that. You know, people come in looking for that Cabernet and say, we don't make Cabernet. We don't grow it here. But Chamberson is a really good workhorse red for us.
Yeah, it seems like you're using it quite a bit throughout your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And then semi-sweets. Okay, now these are interesting. I was looking at these earlier, and it's simply because it seems like you're using a little bit more of the American grapes on this, Vignole and Chaminet and stuff like that.
Yeah, Vignole is another French hybrid. That's the first grape we planted. People used to think it had Pinot Noir in the parentage, but genetically it looks like it probably didn't. There's a little tiny town in France called Vignole. I don't know how they would say it. But the Traminette came out of southern Illinois, I think, is where it was maybe bred. Gewurztraminer parentage.
Oh, does it? And, I didn't know Traminette had Gewurztraminer. No, I never knew that.
So it's got some of that floral character that comes from the Gewurztraminer.
Yeah.
And so we do a straight Traminette, and then we do a little sweeter blend. We'll put it with Vidal Blanc or just some other white to tone down the Traminette a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed you have two Traminettes, though. You have the South Shore White and then the straight varietal Traminette. Why the difference?
Right. Well, the varietal is 100%, so it's got a lot of that floral aroma. The South Shore White is about a 50% blend, so I say it tones down the Traminette flavor, and then we do it as about a 4% residual sugar, whereas the Traminette is usually around maybe a 2% residual sugar.
Oh, so you get a little bit sweeter on the blend, I see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and people like that sweetness, so sometimes I have one that's just a little bit sweeter. The Yellowwood White.
The Yellowwood White, that is usually a blend of Vignole with Cayuga White or Vidal Blanc. Vignole, when it's picked earlier, has that peachy pear aroma. And then the later you go in the picking, the more tropical it gets. So we do a late harvest Vignole that's very sort of tropical pina colada. But in the Yellowwood White, they say it's toned down. But you still get this sort of the peachy pear apricot character. Okay. We usually do two pickings of Vignole, one for the Yellowwood White or the Vignole, and then we do the late harvest later.
Oh, okay. Well, the late harvest, I got to ask about that. What residual sugar you're bringing that in at?
Residual on that's usually 6-7% with a 10% alcohol.
Well, that's a good balance there, I think, if you can keep that consistent.
Yeah. We did an ice wine years ago. Was picked at was pressed out at 44% sugar.
Whoa!
And we fermented that down to about a 10% alcohol and maybe 20% residual sugar. It was just it was like liquid honey.
Yeah, I can imagine. 20%. Oh my gosh! Yeah, it's nectar of the gods when you start.
Yeah, well, that's a difficult fermentation when the sugar's that high.
I can imagine it is. Wow, 44% residual sugar—that's just unbelievable. People don't understand.
Well, that's the starting sugar. Say we ended up around 20.
Yeah, but still, starting it up at that high, it's just you're going, oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah, most ice wines are starting in the mid-30s or so when they're pressed out. So this one's just extremely high.
Yeah, I was going to say 44%. Jeez. You have a Yellowwood Red, too.
Mm-hmm. That's usually a blend. It's a non-vintage blend, stainless steel, no oak. And it's kind of around in that 2.5-3% residual sugar, so it's a very soft red wine, easy drinking, pretty popular.
Yeah, I can imagine. But it's got enough sweetness to it that people will enjoy it, but yet it's not sweet. And that,
right.
That
well, we can get into the sweet ones come.
we are heading for those right now. Sweet wine.
That's right.
Vineyard White, Catawba.
Catawba, yeah, we buy it from New York. And you can buy a Catawba that is white or barely pink, and you can buy a Catawba that is fairly well pinked. So we usually buy the lighter color, which is a little earlier harvest, and it makes a nice white. We finish at, you know, in that 6-8% residual sugar. And then we do a Vineyard Rosé, which is from the same base wine, but we use a little Concord in it to pink it up. So it gives a little different flavor. It's around the same sweetness, though.
Oh, you don't? It doesn't change the residual sugars in it. Oh.
No, they finish out about the same. They have about the same pH and total acidity, so you know, sweetnesses are going to be about the same. And then our Vineyard Red is just a straight Concord. You know, that's what people in the Midwest grew up on.
Yeah.
People are always going to like Concord.
Yeah,
although in our overall sales profile, it has actually been decreasing,
right,
you know, as far as percentage of. So, you know, the U.S. palate has traditionally been pretty sweet.
Yes, it has. I mean, the U.S. palate has always been sweet.
Yeah, if you go back to country wines, as they're called, where people were making homemade wines, and they were picking grapes. They had no canopy management. Clusters were hidden in the canopy, and they didn't really get that ripe. And so when they made wine, it had a lot of acid. And if you had no technology to speak of, the only way to balance that acidity was with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to keep the sugar from fermenting was to have high alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So you get these 18% sweet Concord wines as kind of the traditional country style wine. Going back 2 or 3 generations here.
Yeah, and there's still some wineries in the Midwest and Kentucky and different areas that make it like that too. I've talked to
I mean, a lot of people that's the bread and butter for the winery.
Yeah, and they, you know, I've. I know of in Kentucky that does that. It is very sweet, very high alcohol, and
mm-hmm.
he says it sells like crazy. He says people just love it.
Yeah, they can fly out the door. Here in Bloomington, we have the university, Indiana University, roughly 40-some thousand students, and there's probably 10,000 international students here. So Bloomington has a fair international character to it. And you usually find your dry wine drinkers in urban areas, but Bloomington has a fair share of those people. So our wine list is maybe skewed a little drier than if we were way out in the country here.
Oh, well,
you got to make the wines to sell to the market.
That reminds me, years ago when I had the winery, I had some sweeter wines. And I had this guy come in and says, if I had a winery, I wouldn't make any sweet wines at all. Every one of them would be bone dry. And I go, yes. And as the people walk out the door, you'd be running after them saying, I can add sugar. I can make it sweeter. You know, because I'm not going to buy them.
Yeah. But, you know, I've been in this business 40-some years, and you know, things have changed quite a bit, especially with younger people who have more experience with wine. We're shifting away from that really sweet palate somewhat.
Yeah, you know, but it's still inbred, I think, in the American taste, you know, and especially.
Well, we grow up on Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
That's about 10% residual sugar.
Yeah, and even young kids now, I mean, you know. I say young kids. I'm an old man. So, but even you know, early 20s and stuff like that, they go down to Starbucks and they get themselves a coffee. But it's not a coffee; it's a sweet drink. I mean, it's what it is. And so they go to a winery and you pour them a dry wine, and it's like, ooh, you know, do you, don't you have anything sweeter? And then, you know, you start getting sweeter and sweeter because this is what they know. And so, and I think it's affecting the sales of wine because you see that the Gen Y and Gen X are not buying as much wine. And I think it's because they just grew up on the sweetness and wines aren't all sweet. You know, all there's
a lot of competition in the marketplace for people's beverage choices. You know, we have the power waters and carbonated this and that and flavored waters. And so that's made a difference in all, you know, craft brewing, craft distilling has taken some of the shine. So it's a hugely competitive market now.
Oh, tremendous. And wineries are starting to feel the effects of that, too, because people only have so much discretionary dollars to spend on that stuff. After rent and electric and gas and things that they have to pay, there's only so much discretionary money left over. And everybody's competing for that. And so,
right. Well, we know that you can go into a liquor store and you can buy wine cheaper than, you know, we can make it. You know, so part of going to the winery is the experience. So we try to offer a really nice experience for people.
And that's an important thing about a winery is that experience.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It looks like you're heading towards the fruit wines here on the list.
I am.
Okay.
When I had the winery, I made some fruit wines too. So these are always interesting to me when I see fruit wines available. The blackberry.
Yeah, blackberry. I say we just bottled peach today, but blackberry is our single. Yeah, blackberry is our single biggest selling wine. It's the main. We do some wholesaling, and that's the main wine that goes through the wholesaler. When you run across these fruit wines, they're not competing directly with things coming out of California. So that, you know, we have all these fruits here in the Midwest, you know, peaches, blackberries, blueberries, currants, apple, you know, that's all available here. Take advantage of these things.
Did you fall down?
No, I'm in the cellar, and there's actually a bottle that fell off the... off of something.
Oh, no. Didn't break?
Didn't break. Landed in the sink.
Oh, good. Okay. So the blackberry, is it, well, I see it says with a hint of tartness. Is what's the alcohol level on your blackberry?
The fruit wines, we do them all at 10.5%.
Okay.
When you take the alcohol up to 12-13%, the alcohol kind of blows away the fresh flavors of the fruits.
Yeah,
so
but still,
lighter, 10.5.
You know, I kept mine down around, I don't know, 8.5, 9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I just, you know, didn't want the alcohol, that bite in there. I didn't want the fruit definitely to come out.
Mm-hmm.
But 10.5, that's where I noticed you said it. The blackberry has that blackberry tartness, and that's probably a little bit of that alcohol popping in there.
Well, it's the tartness from the fruit. We try to make the fruit wines like you were tasting the fruit, and you know, blackberries have a little tartness to them. And if you hit that little point right between that sweet tart character, that's where we like to put it. So it doesn't really come across as tart, but it's not what you call syrupy sweet either.
That's good.
A lot of people make fruit wines, you know, just way too sweet.
Ooh, yes.
At least for me, for my taste.
Me too. Yeah. So, but again, back to the fact that people like those and they look for those. You know, your blueberry, Indiana grown blueberries. That's cool.
Yeah, there's roughly, at least there used to be 900 acres of blueberries up in northern Indiana. Then that just goes on up into Michigan where there's even more blueberries. So we have a good supply of blueberries here.
I guess whenever we see blueberries in the store, then that must be where they come from.
Well, it could be. There are blueberries grown in the South. They're grown in South America. They're grown in New England. So it's a pretty widely distributed fruit.
Well, and there's a place not too far in north of us here that does blueberries, but there was an abundance of them about 8 years ago, and they plowed under I don't know how many tons of blueberries because it was just they had no market for them. There was
wow.
just blueberries everywhere, and so you know it's a roll of the dice on that stuff. Spiced apple.
That's a fairly new one for us. Four or 5 years maybe. But you know, it's cinnamon, nutmeg, you know, orange peel, all those sorts of things. You know,
so it does taste like spiced apple.
Oh yeah, it's again a 10.5%. We just make an apple wine, and then we put the spices in it for about a week.
There you go.
Filter it and bottle it. So it's one of our coming up here in October. Will probably be one of our biggest sales for a month or so.
Oh yeah, yeah, Halloween, yeah. That sounds good. That spice apple does sound good. And then the peach, you just bottled that. Where you get your peaches?
Yeah. We kind of buy peaches on the bulk market.
Okay.
We don't have peach orchards right around here. So it's something we can, you know, you can go through a broker and get.
Yeah.
And we've not found a lot of difference. You know, there are different kinds of peaches. There's clings and freestones and stuff. But peach makes a fairly delicate wine or lighter flavored wine, I would say. And that's probably our sweetest wine on the list because a lot of people, when they think of peaches, they want to open up that can of peaches and you've got lighter, heavy syrup there.
Yes.
that's the flavor and the aroma they're looking for.
And that's what people think. When they think of peaches, they think of that can of syrup. That's funny. That's a good point. And then your specialty wine. You got three of those. Your late harvest, is that getting toward ice wine style there?
Well, that's, say, it's 6 or 7% residual. So it's kind of the step before ice wine. We're not, you know, it's not freezing on the vine. We're not, you know, freezing it in a freezer. So it's just a good, naturally sweet, very, very aromatic when vinola is picked late. Very much that tropical finish, pineapple, pears. So it's been a good, steady one for a number of years. We've been making that for 20-some years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That sounds good. And late harvest, if it's done right, can really be a nice complement to a meal or dessert with some good cheesecake. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
A sparkling wine. I never did a sparkling wine. People always ask for it, but I stayed away from it.
We made them in the early 80s when we first opened up, mid 80s, up to about the late 90s. We've just gotten back into it again. So this is a bottle fermented. We have the Vidal, and we made a little bit of Chamberson Rosé sparkling last year and sold out real quick. So we just bottled up another batch, and it's sitting on the yeast right now. Sparklings are fun. They're fairly popular with young people. You know, they're not just for special occasions anymore, but... Fun wines to make.
I preach that on the show. Drink sparkling wines anytime. That's always a fun wine to have anytime. Yeah. I never did attempt sparkling wine. It just that scared me. So, black currant. I did.
Yeah. We make the Obsession series, blueberry, cherry, and black currant. And these are all the basic fruits, and then we fortify them with brandy, so they're about 18% alcohol. So we're trying to put as much of the fruit flavor into these as we can. And we buy Indiana's entire production of black currants. We didn't this year, but in the past we have. So there's really one commercial grower in northern Indiana. And black currants are a very intense flavor. They're the strongest flavor of, you know, the red currants, gold currants, and such, so...
Yeah, black currants. They're good, though. Black currants are
I love the flavor. A lot of people taste them, and they're too tart, but, yeah, they're wonderful.
They are. I think so, too. I'm right with you there. And then ports.
I love ports.
Me, too. I made a strawberry port when I had the winery, and that was a very, very big seller. You know.
So we make one we call Terra Rossa. That's the name of the soil here, the red clay soils. And it's the one we just bottled here recently was 30 months in barrel. Usually we're about 18 months, but we have one that's extended. So
30 months.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Chambersin is what we use for it. So if you're comparing it, say, to a Portuguese port or something that's coming from a grape with more tannins, ours is less tannic, but we don't sweeten it up as much. So we're usually around 5 or 6% residual sugar, while other ports may be around 9%.
Yeah.
Well, so it's a little...
You're using that Chambersin for everything. I mean, it seems to be your workhorse in the winery there.
It is, yeah. Yep.
And then
the reds tend, the red grapes tend to be the least cold hardy. You know, whites generally are more cold hardy than, and that's what's one reason we're we make more whites than reds, I guess, when looking at the list. Yeah.
Yeah, the Chambersin is pretty hardy though, isn't it?
It is. You know, we rely on probably the average age of a Chambersin trunk when it's replaced is probably about 5 years. A lot of crown gall damage in it. So, but say you just grow up a new sucker, and the next year you've got a new trunk. So we can bring up a sucker and vine that has a poor trunk, take crop off of that poor trunk, and then replace it with a new trunk the next year. So, you know, we're never really missing a crop if you do it that way.
No, that's a good way to do it. Here's another use of a black currant. You're making a port-style wine out of it. That would be really good.
We want to make something that's about as intense as you can make, and black currant is the one to do. You know, we're picking grapes with about, you know, under 1%. Total acidity. Currants can come in around 4% total acidity.
Wow.
So they're almost like little lemons in a way. So getting the acid down and smoothing the wine out is really the main operation in black currants. But very intense flavors. You know, the fresh fruit is kind of like a piney, minty thing. You put it in your mouth and it just kind of explodes with flavor.
Yeah, that's black currant does that too. It's got a great flavor to it. And then you got the last two, the cherry and the blueberry. Seems like they are two different fruits for the same thing.
Yeah, just like the black currant obsession. Yeah, so we're taking our base blueberry wine and we're adding brandy to it. And I know that some people, if you've ever had a blueberry wine that's been in barrel, we have not done that. But I know in New England there are some great blueberry wines that are barrel aged. So blueberry, I would say blueberry is the fruit that's closer to grapes than anything else as far as winemaking goes. Has a fairly thick skin.
Yeah,
it has more tannins to it. And a lot of fruits have, you know, the acids are just different. And blueberries are fairly tame acid. You know, black currant has ascorbic acid, vitamin C in it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never considered blueberry being closer to the grape, but you're absolutely right. It's thinking back of the flavors and tastes and the skin thickness and all that, the blueberry is very close to a grape. And I want to point out, too, your wines are all reasonably priced. They're not outrageous. Most of them are below 15 until you get into your port-style wines, and then those jump up. Your sparkling wine's a little bit higher, but sparkling wines usually are because it's more effort. And it is.
Oh, and the tax is 20 times as high.
And the tax. We can't forget that.
Yeah, that's very true. We really haven't had a price increase. We're looking at, you know, a year ago we started seeing the price increases. You know, bottles are 30% more. Everything's pretty much going up 30% in the last year and a half.
Yeah.
And that is not really quite reflected in our prices yet because some of this we're selling, you know, in wineries you need an inventory that's 18 months. So it takes a while for some of these costs to get passed through. And we try to keep them reasonable.
They are.
You know, we're not in California. We're not selling $200 bottles of wine.
Oh, yeah. That's a little bit ridiculous, if you ask me. Yeah, all of yours are really reasonably priced. And you mentioned bottles. I closed the winery in 2016, and the bottle prices were jumping up a lot when I closed. It was scary how much bottles were going to cost, and they've done nothing but just continue to climb since then. I don't see how wineries can survive just paying for bottles.
Well, just getting bottles, you know, this year hasn't been bad, but the year or two before, you know, and everything was in shortage, bottles were essentially rationed. You know, we deal with a wholesale supplier, and he said, well, you know, tell me what you need next year because I need to know now just to be able to get them in. So it's a totally different world.
Yeah.
We didn't see that problem with cork so much, but bottles was the main problem.
Yeah, and I understand capsules, too, were having an issue.
Somewhat, yeah. What happened with bottles? The Chinese came into the market 10 years ago, and so a lot of big wineries went to Chinese glass, which was probably 20% cheaper or more. And then when China was cut off and nothing was coming in, the North American supply just couldn't supply the industry.
Yeah, there's just so much all of a sudden now. And that's just about the time that, you know, like I say, about the time I closed wine in 2016, bottle prices were outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started to worry about how I was going to be paying for bottles. You know, now, let's see, what else? Let me get back up here to the top and see. Okay. You have a wine club?
We do. It's easy to join, no cost.
Oh, no cost.
So basically you're getting a case of wine a year. We do three releases at four bottles each. So no hurdles.
That makes it a lot easier. And you have basically all of your wines over the period of year ends up going out, it looks like, on this here, too. So that's, you know, that's a good thing. Well, Jim, before we go here, Mike, do you have any questions, comments to Jim before we say goodnight?
Nope, I think I'm good. I appreciate it. Thank you. It's very interesting.
Jim, before we let you go, what I would like you to do is give us all the pertinent information about Butler Winery. How to get a hold of you, what your web address is, Facebook, phone numbers, you want to give it out, everything. And location and all that. So if anybody decides to order something or check out your website or visit, then they've got all the information that they want there. So if you give us all that, please.
Okay. So we're Butler Winery, located in Bloomington, Indiana, 6200 East Robinson Road. 8 or 9 miles northeast of downtown Bloomington. Our website's butlerwinery.com. Our main phone number here is 812-332-6660. If you want to order wine, you know, we go through Vino Shipper. We can ship to 30-some states. So if you go to our website, you'll find that pertinent information. We are on Facebook. I don't have much involvement with that myself, so I can't tell you too much more about it. We do music on Sunday afternoons, May through October. And we do all sorts of music, country, jazz, you know, kind of music on the side. We don't call it concerts, but and we have a lot of outside seating. We do some events here. We got an event coming up in October for Wildcare. It's a charity event that we do every year.
Oh, very
so
good.
Are
you open year-round, or do you close in the winter months?
We're open year-round. We're closed 3 days, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's.
Oh, okay. Okay, because that's weather affects people in that area, and I just wondered if you happen to...
It affects them in various ways. After about the second or third day when they've been inside, they're just dying to get out and do something.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
So it's the first day of snow, but after that, you know, they're going to get out.
Get me out of here. Let's go to the winery.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Well, Jim, thank you for taking your time to join us tonight. It was very, very educational.
Yep.
And, again, if anybody's interested in that book, that sounds like that might be something that y'all can check out if you want to know something about Indiana or that area. Indiana Wine, A History, and it's from Indiana University Press. So
that's right.
Check that out. And if you're ever up in that area, and if I'm ever up in that area, I will definitely stop by and visit you. Thank
you
so
much. Please
stop
in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been fun.
It has. You don't require reservations for tasting, do you?
No, we don't.
Okay. A lot of places
for groups
do,
of eight people or more, we don't call it a reservation, but it's nice if you notify us because then we can kind of help arrange the seating. But
yeah.
For walk-ins, you know, we don't really do reservations.
All right. A lot of places do, and that's why I'm asking now.
Yeah, we've got enough seating outside. We haven't had that trouble. We can put tables up in the cellar and such, so... Maybe someday we will. I don't know.
There's always that hope. We are so busy. So, all right, Jim, thank you for taking your time, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to visit you and talk in person one day.
Okay, please do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
All right. Wow. There it goes.
It's got a lot of different wines there. That, you know, and a credit to the American wines too, American grapes. I mean, he's talking about the French hybrids, but he's also putting a lot of American fruit in the ground, and that's, you know, something you expect from the Midwest there, and that's nice. So
yeah.
So
you were
thinking
you were. Checking, you were talking about, or the name was Clark Smith that
Clark
we had
Smith.
On the show. He was an expert on Native American grapes. And
yeah.
It's been a few months,
2 months, I think, since he was on. But I somebody on last week, and I tend to forget names. I'm horrible, horrible about that. I really am. Yeah, I get on the golf course and somebody passes. Hi, Ron, how you doing? I go, hi, buddy. Hi, guy. Hi, you know, pal. Hi, you know, I don't remember the name. So.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, that's all right.
So, yeah. So, before we go, let me jump in on finishing this article here quickly. It's about... the private labels. It says alcohol assortments are showcasing domestic and international wines, including wines from South Africa and Western Eastern Europe, plus sparkling wines, box wines, organic and fair trade wines. These are all being private labeled. It says convenience store chain Circle K debuted a private label wine, Sunshine Bliss, in Chardonnay, Moscato, and other varietals. Albertsons introduced the Vinifor collection. Gelson's Markets in Southern California added four wines to its store brand, Napa Valley Collection. And there's stores all over the country that are doing their own private labels, and they are doing quite well. And they're finding that the markup for doing private labels is much better than if they sell name wines, and it's not taken away from the sales a lot of the name wines, but it is boosting their sales. So private labels, it's been around. When we had the winery, we were looking at doing a private label for Albertsons, or no, Cash and Carry. We talked with them and was almost in the works, and trouble is, whenever you start dealing with grocery stores, the people you talk to 6 months from now, they may not be there. They're promoted and transferred and all that. And we went through four different people over a period of like a year that we had to do the presentation all over again and convince them how good it would be and all that. And then finally, Cash and Carry started getting trouble, and so they decided to close down a lot of the stores. So, but yeah, the private label is very, very popular in this country. When you walk in, you see it. It's, if you look on the back, you can usually see the parent company, but it's not required. A lot of them put it on there, but it's not required. So, very.
All right. That's good stuff. Those. Now, there was something else that was, I can't remember. Well, it is, they're almost in sync. There is 8:15 p.m. Eastern Time, and we will have a show next week, which is the 28th, the last
Tobin.
Thursday of September. Is it what? Tobin?
Tobin.
Oh, he's
will
coming
be
out?
Our guest next week.
Oh,
remember?
Wow.
A few weeks ago, we had Tobin's brother on the show from that movie. And now, Tobin is going to be our guest. And Tobin was, it was his house that was used for the majority of the movie. I can't think of the name of the movie. I told you I'm terrible on names. Tobin will be
Terry
our guest.
Terry Shumrick was the guest. And I'm trying to... Oh, gosh, I know it's in here somewhere. It's one of these things. Scroll up and take notes. Page 400, page 900.
Flip, 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 flip.
What the? Page Shumrick, movie brother. There it is. Terry Shumrick, Wine Thief.
The Wine Thief movie. And this Tobin is his brother who, well, it was his house that was used and all that. And Tobin is the winemaker of fame. So he'll be on next week and be able to talk with us about the movie some more and also about his wines and all that. So should be fun next week also.
We'll look forward to that. So, tune in on September 28th and 7 p.m. Eastern Time if you want to catch it live, which is preferable, but, you know, that's okay. Delayed or rebroadcast or archives are always good, too, so we appreciate it. Lots of places. We'll close the show out for this Saturday, and we'll talk to you all next for this Thursday. We'll talk to you all
this
next Thursday.
It's your Flightline Radio that's on Saturday. This is Thursday.
Okay.
Which is a subtle way of getting another plug in for Flightline Radio live Saturday mornings from 7 to 9.
Not intentional. All right. Have a good one.
Have a good week. Yeah, be safe.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archive shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
I forgot to turn the mic back on. Oh, okay. Green room real quick.